Chapter 24. The biomechanoid weapon was deeply embedded in Dervla's nervous system now, employing finely judged neural cutouts to isolate her conscious awareness and any physical volition from the rest of her body. Now, her body was like a shell, and she was like the kernel rattling around inside as it and the gun went about their business. That's how it seemed at first, but later, she realised that this analogy wasn't right, and as the Dervla shell lurched around, cradling that horrible living gun, a memory from a couple of years ago just rose up and hit her with a shiver of recognition. Back then, she had been on the Scarabus for less than a year, during which time she had acquired the beginnings of the basic skill set – weapons, explosives and net running mainly. Pike had brought them to the Demoneff system, home to the Gulbas Orbital, one of Earthsphere's bigger navy installations. Pike's destination was an asteroid called Plexus, a place for cheap refits at knockdown prices. Plexus, run by a one-eyed Gomedra called Plexi, relied on a supply of mouthed or obsolete equipment scavenged from the Gulbas discard bins by shady types eager for easy cash. The Plexi asteroid, in addition to its refurb pits, had been thoroughly tunnelled, its interior a maze of passages and chambers, including a room full of power armour and exosuits. So, while the Scarabus was getting its hull shield emitters upgraded, Plexi offered to let Dervla take one of the combat exosuits out for a drive. She remembered seeing the suit, a brute, heavily armoured thing standing in its charger booth. The original livery must have been dark green and blue, but wear and tear had abraded much of the paint job away, leaving bare edges and corners that gleamed in the harsh light of the overheads. Dervla had clambered up, twisted round, slipped arms and legs into their padded grooves, while Plexi went over to a control pedestal from where he powered up the suit systems. At his prompting, she moved the arms and legs a little, then made it step forward out of the booth. And almost seriously overbalanced, feeling the suit tilt forward, fearing that she was going to literally fall on her face, until Plexi activated some auto-balance subsystem, which snapped the upper torso back, righting her immediately. Over the next hour or so, she learned how to walk, how to move her arms, how to monitor the balance sensors, how to swivel, how to pick things up and throw them, how to carry a heavy weapon in one of those big four-fingered hands, and how to fire it. And that, she reckoned, was closer to how she felt now. As if her own body had been turned into unfamiliar flesh, which this vile invader, this ancient defiling presence, seemed to understand better than she did. She grew certain that the biomech was secreting narcotizing drugs directly into her brain. While conscious and alert, she barricaded herself against any cooperation with the biomech in thought or deed. But sometimes her awareness blurred and drifted, and she could feel herself listening to a smooth, persuasive voice, then answering, then agreeing. Later, even the memories of these interludes seemed dreamlike and disjointed, but it was entirely clear that, like Plexi and the exosuit, she was being taught how to cooperate with a tutor, except that this teacher was also her jailer. Her early life had been a struggle to escape a severe and malicious domination, and later she had gone to great lengths to avoid falling under the control of others, and yet here she was, plunged into a nightmarish version of the very worst of what she had experienced. Being physically at the mercy of pitiless enemies was bad enough, but the drugs and their attendant web of soothing lies meant that she was unable to trust herself. Exrahuld was perpetually followed by a coterie of aides, retainers, underlings and sycophants, shuskars each and every one. To this audience, the biomech parasite would deliver impromptu, pompous lectures, usually on the subject of its many previous hosts and the countless victories it had gained over a long sequence of enemies. These self-aggrandizing monologues were never received with anything less than rapturous, adulatory applause. And as the hours of her grotesque incarceration ground on, Dervla's contempt for these grovelling Shuskar hangers-on was distilled into a strange kind of hate. From the Biomex comments and other hints, she came to understand that centuries of service to these vile tyrants had twisted the Shuskar into an underclass of indoctrinated minions, driven by the fearful minutiae of a hierarchy wholly dependent on the whim of those same tyrants. During one of those grandiose lectures, Exra Huld had spoken of a long quest for the perfect host species, one strong enough and versatile enough to provide a vehicle worth keeping, worth conquering with, one truly capable of fulfilling the all-encompassing ambitions of the Biomech and its four companions. It spoke approvingly, almost hungrily, about human physiology, and pondered plans for capturing other humans. That was when she realised that time was against her, that there was no guarantee that Pike or anyone could possibly free her from the utter certainty of a capitulation and indoctrination, just as total and demeaning as that exhibited by the Shuskar. The only way out was death, an ending to close the door on her own life. That, however, would mean gaining a measure of conscious control, and that would mean cooperation, a conceding, presenting a convincing simulacrum of voluntary collaboration. But what would she have to do to persuade the Biomech that it was getting what it wanted? The long, long climb out of the imprisoning depths of a Kreen's mind was temporarily arduous. It seemed to be taking forever. As they progressed, Gredaz's focusing exercises continued to work minor marvels. The spidery trees and bushes now had tiny ash-grey leaves, and more than once a Kreen saw winged creatures flitting across the misty, endless stairway. For a short time it struck him as both exhilarating and freakish that he was travelling through his own mental terrain with a precursor who created enduring spectral surroundings out of, well, out of what, exactly? Twisted shared perceptions? The unused capacities at the back of his mind? But such speculation palled after a time, and Akreen set the matter aside as a minor imponderable. Instead, he focused on trying to follow the comments, curses, and exchanges taking place between his usurping precursors. As near as he could be sure, it appeared that they, led by Rajeg, were still in league with the vile Khor and continuing his pursuit of the Zavri ancestor by following the faint resonances peculiar to Zavri biophysiology. Only they had given up trudging around the maze of corridors and stairs and were now using the Zavri body strength to literally punch and tear away through walls if there was no easy route close by. This approach caused several minor cave-ins along the way, and a couple of major ones that left Akreen's physical form completely, though temporarily, buried. Even with these delays, however, they were still making faster progress than they had before. Akreen did note how his precursors still reflexively indulged their vestigial character traits, despite being collectively in the ascendancy. Kasek's, venting his outrage, was like the blare of battle horns. Ifan was the essence of superior indignation. Togol's monumental disdain could belittle a conqueror of worlds. Drom's irritation served only to elevate his own paramount importance. While at the head of this fractious squad was Cold Rajek, who proved adept at exerting pressure in a variety of forms – lack of time, snap decisions, expectation of others, in this case Khor, who carried the anti-Zavri weapon, possible loss of honour, and even possibly appearing weak and indecisive. And at every juncture they went along with Rajeg's suggestion. Akreen had to admit, it was masterful. And after that earlier assessment, he had realised that one of his precursors, Zivolin, the mischief-maker, was conspicuous by his absence. Which was not a bad thing, he decided. So the plodding ascent through the imagined landscape went on, and his precursor's childish squabbling continued to filter down from the heights of his conscious mind, echoes and disjointed fragments of angry dialogue and monologues. Paths were still being smashed through decrepit walls while Rajeg maintained his working relationship with Khor. Then Akreen heard them babbling about the gang of humans who were spotted crossing a bridge. But that had been well over 5 hours ago, according to Rajeg, who was enjoying seeing how long every task took, down to the second. Rajeg's exchanges with Khor seemed to be mainly on the subject of Zavri social hierarchy, precursors, and lineal descendancy, and it seemed clear that Rajeg was merely humouring him. Gredaz slowed to a halt on the stair a couple of paces ahead and half-turned to look down at Akreen.
"Be advised that we shall soon arrive at the subcognitive plateau, where we must wait."
Saying no more, the tall figure, now garbed in full-length battle elder's robes, turned and resumed his climb.
"Plateau," said Akreen. "You made no mention of this before."
"It did not exist before."
Gredaz's logic was undeniable. Akreen kept on going, letting the repetitious tedium of one foot after another absorb his awareness until it took on a mesmeric quality which, oddly, added details to his surroundings. Scratches and worn edges on the stairs. Clusters of shiny purple berries on the bushes. Little yellow flowers on the gnarled-looking tree branches. A light impact on his chest made him stop, abruptly dispelling his reverie. Gredaz had stopped him with an outstretched hand, which he then swept out to his side in a grand unveiling gesture.
"We have arrived. This is the subcognitive plateau."
The fog had dissolved into a thin mist, and Akreen could see an expanse of dark, barren rock spread out before him, wide enough that its edges were hazy grey. When he looked back the way they had come, the steep stone stairs wound down to disappear in thick fog. All around and above were shifting billows of grey.
"So we cannot go any further," Akreen guessed out loud.
"Correct. In this metaphorical context, above us, beyond the veil of non-awareness, your precursors are enthroned in the courts of perception, to a greater or lesser degree. While they prevail, we cannot proceed."
Akreen felt an urge to be openly disdainful of their situation, but decided instead to trust that Gredaz was in fact following some kind of rational plan.
"All that we can do now is wait," he said evenly.
"We wait, hopefully, just for a short while."
Gredaz directed a stony gaze at the shifting grey overhead.
"Our presence here will not go unnoticed for long."
Akreen gave him a narrow look.
"You are expecting us to be noticed? By whom?"
Gredaz glanced at him.
"You are not the only one receiving the benefit of my counsel."
Akreen stared at him, feeling slightly dislocated by that comment.
"Not the only one?"
Was Gredaz in contact with the outside world? But how would that be possible? And who would he be counselling? Suddenly and thoroughly unexpectedly, Gredaz laughed, a dry, slightly hoarse sound. A sharp smile occupied his lips as he looked over at Akreen.
"At last," he said, pointing upwards. "Listen to them and be ready."
Gredaz was right. The steady background mutter of exchanges, arguments, and bitter asides from above had surged in volume and anger. Incoherent roars passed back and forth, principally involving Ifan and Kasex, with Rajeg issuing contemptuous denials in between his attempts to cope with the real-world journey through the corridors. Akreen marvelled at how the petty squabbles of those vestigial personae could sound so vast and godlike from this perspective. Then, Another voice cut across the thunderous, raging bellowing of Togol, a stream of accusations of betrayal and deadly insults besmirching his honour. And just when it seemed that the deafening sound could not get any louder, the voices of Cassex and Ifan rose to a wrathful clamour, building the cacophony to a crescendo.
"Get ready!"
yelled Gredaz, pointing upwards.
"Keep your nerve! You will experience no discomfort!"
Seconds later, gravity drained away, replaced by a force tugging them upwards, slowly at first, then faster, gaining velocity, flying through white streaming fog. Then, something snatched him out of that crazed headlong ascent and dropped him into abrupt reality. Sense impressions jolted him, almost leaping at him so swiftly that he gasped. He was lying sprawled and alone on the floor of a dim corridor, amid the dusty debris smashed out of a hole in the wall. As he levered himself into a seated position, he noticed fragments of metal scattered among the rubble. Then, looking around, he saw the split and shattered wreckage of a weapon that he knew all too well.
"I have it on good authority that Khor received something of a beating before he managed to escape," said Gredaz.
"Ha! It was a thing of beauty," said Zivalin. "My carefully orchestrated campaign of innuendo and half-truths brought them to a pitch-perfect brink of pent-up fury and hate.
As soon as you reached the plateau, I triggered the final bitter notes of my symphony of rancor. As you can see, it has played out to a most satisfactory conclusion."
As Akreen got to his feet, he picked up the wrecked anti-Zavri weapon and saw where repeated impacts had smashed apart the emitter barrel.
"So, what actually happened?" he said in his thoughts. "Where is Khor?"
Zivalin was effusive with self-congratulation.
"Well, my hate drama, being a drama of hate, needed a secondary antagonist as an external focus of the acrid hate storm I was stirring up. Someone to serve as a stand-in for grand diabolical powers, single-minded in their dread resolve. Rajeg, of course, was primary antagonist, the betrayer. Ifan and Cassex were primed to seize control from Rajeg and attack the unsuspecting Khor. Togol, however, had become convinced that the pair of them were conspiring against him. So, with Rajeg ejected from the seat of command and those three fools brawling like senile toys, your presence on the plateau was all that was needed to tilt the cognitive balance in your favour."
"Most skillfully done, honoured Zivalin," Akreen said. "And what of Khor?"
"Ran off, bloody and beaten," said Gredaz. "I caught a glimpse of Ifan's handiwork while he was in control for a few moments."
Akreen tossed the broken weapon away and surveyed his surroundings. Ancient, eroded corridors, poorly lit in patches by strange clusters of crystal-like nodes that gave off soft, opaque glows. Cracked walls spilling heaps of pebbly dirt, in which emaciated plants had at one time taken root, sprouted, withered, and died. Ceiling collapses, half-blocking passages, but occasionally providing an accessible slope to the floor above. And there, right there at the faint and trembling edge of perception, something was resonating, a kind of high, sighing hum that called to him.
"Can you hear it?" said Gredaz.
"The song of the ancestor," said Zivalin. "A summons out of antiquity."
"Yes," Akreen said. "I can hear it. But how can a Zavri live for thousands of years and not be noticed?"
"He can, if his mode of existence is closer to death than life," came a new voice.
From the shadows along one corridor, a floating blue point of light came gliding towards him. As it drew near, Akreen saw that it was an odd, ridged spheroid, smaller than his fist, and that the light was a diffuse blue beam projected from one of several apertures.
At last, said Gredas, a messenger from the one that guards the ancestor.
The glowing device slowed to a halt a couple of paces away.
Welcome, Akreen, first blade of the Zavri battalions.
Akreen stared at the hovering remote.
I'm told that you speak for the one that guards the ancestor.
Well, we all speak in that capacity in one way or another.
So, do you represent the Apparatarch, or whatever it has become?
The same question as before, yet more pointedly framed. We call ourselves the Inheritors, even though our inheritance amounts to a few trinkets and relics and an insurmountable burden of responsibility. But we must make do with what we are given or chance upon, and it was our good fortune that your precursor Gredas heard the subtle coded message which we fed into the portal web.
Akreen nodded, still racked with uncertainty.
Are you satisfied that I am who I say I am? I have experienced some fundamental disturbances since my arrival, challenging to the very core of my being.
For us, the Zavri aura is as telling as the facial expressions of other species. So yes, First Blade, we can tell from the comfort and harmony indicators that you are the rightful possessor of this form. The previous occupier gave off such a garish clash of hues that we knew to avoid making any contact.
This is a great relief, Akreen said. I am now ready to learn all you can tell me about the ancestor before whatever happens next.
Good. However, we are presented with a problem.
Tsk! The long, long centuries must turn these machine intellects into lovers of prevarication, said Zivalin.
Akreen remained composed. What kind of problem?
It is to do more with ends than means. You see, after the unfortunate ambush you suffered at the hands of that Shuskar thug, Khor, we concluded that you were a lost cause, and with time for ploys growing short, we opted for the only available option.
A pair of spheroid remotes, identical to the first, descended from a break in the ceiling and lined up next to it.
The explanation covers ancient history as well as recent events, and therefore is a little intricate,
the remote said.
So, rather than have you plod all the way to the ancestor chamber, we can transport you there in a bearer field and tell you all you need to know as we travel. Is that agreeable?
Most agreeable, said Gredas.
Very glib, and thus untrustworthy, said Zivalin. These ancient machines always have some twisty agenda.
Despite sharing Zivalin's reservations, Akreen accepted the invitation, and moments later was being whisked along corridors while reclining in a force field web projected by all three remotes. He learned new things about the Great Unshackling War, the millennia-ago war that obliterated the Apparatarch and its allies, while elevating the victorious rebels led by the Shuskar and their ominous Gun Lords. He heard tell of the Ancestor, a Zavri general called Khaldro Vryn, who approached the mines of the Apparatarch near the war's end while the forces of the Shuskar were drawing ever closer. Of how Khaldro Vryn had told them of his intention to undergo a crystallizing metamorphosis and asked them to find a safe hiding place for his final form, an Incarnalith. He heard of how they'd agreed and buried his crystalline remains deep underground, only when the Shuskar fleet started their bombardment for it to prove not to be deep enough, field-driven vibrations from their mantle munitions penetrating the armoured vault and shattering the Incarnalith into thousands of fragments. The explanatory account then switched to more recent events, and Akreen was surprised to learn of the appearance of the human Pike and his companions, then astonished to hear that the same Pike had been chosen to play host to the shards of the Incarnalith.
This is the only available option that you spoke of earlier, Akreen said.
You were enthralled to your precursors, said the Inheritor Remote. We could not possibly use you as a host. So when the human and his crew appeared a while later and followed your tracks into the deep city, we contrived to separate him from the rest and convey him to the Incarnalith chamber exactly as we are doing with you.
Is he still here? Ongatuzna?
Long gone, First Blade. He and his companions have gone to meet with another band of valiant rebels with the purpose of stealing a fleet world ship to use against the Citadel world. The intention is for this pike to gain access to the Shuskar control hub there, at which point the Incarnalith shards will pass from him into the enemy's control systems. Full mastery of the portal web and the Shadow Force defences will, at a stroke, fall from their grasp.
So, why are you taking me to the Ancestor?
Because we need someone to cross over into the Sunheart and distract the Gunlords while Pike takes over their communication and control systems. Akreen was stunned.
The Sunheart? Where the great star drives reside? Where the Warcage derives its power and energy? I have only ever heard children's stories about it. I did not know that it was possible to travel there.
Our sun is as much a creation of the Builder's genius as the portal web and the world anchors, said the remote. The drives are self-maintaining, self-repairing, and impregnable. But the vast catavaults hold other secrets and power, as well as the star drive control boards and the navigational system. You can see the inherent risks.
Akreen frowned. Would the Shuskar really set the Warcage on a collision course with another star system?
The Underleaders might not, but it is likely that the parasitic Gunlords would, if they are faced with certain defeat.
Certain defeat? Akreen echoed. How plausible can that be?
Our probability studies assigned it a low rating,
said the Inheritor Remote.
But in a complex system, unseen variables can have strange multiplier effects. At any rate, your presence in the Sunheart with the Incarnalith remnants offers the chance to shut the Shuskar out from control of the star drives and all other systems. They will be fatally weakened, and, Gunlords or no, their days will be numbered.
Damn, these machines are persuasive, said Zivalin. I'd sing the battalion anthem if I knew the words, but then who can win battles with charisma alone?
For once, I share your precursor's doubts, Gredaz said. You should ask how they intend to get you to the Sunheart from here. I had heard that the only way was through a portal gate on the Citadel world.
Giving a wordless internal assent, Akreen then said, May I know how you are going to convey me to the Sunheart?
By our unrivaled yet subtle use of the portal web, said the remote. We were with the Builders when they created it. We were their assistants, critics, mirrors for a myriad designs, and overseers of their gradual emergence into the stuff of reality. The millennia have not dimmed our most precious memories. Thus, we still know of certain pathways which can give access to secret places of the Warcage. Although some pathways can only be used once, obviously.
By now, Akreen's journey had reached the huge, sheer-sided gulf that cut through the underground complex. He could feel a cool breeze on his unelaborate dermal covering as the remotes bore him down into shadowy depths. He descended past levels of sliced open rooms and corridors, all like a decayed, weather-worn parody of sedimentary existences. A dark opening appeared off in the hazy murk, loomed closer and closer, and swallowed them all. Along a tilted, debris-strewn passageway they swept,
the cold blue beams of the remotes picking out corroded details right along the length of it before they came to where a large, heavy hatch stood wide open. Through it they dived, flew level for a few seconds, then pitched into another descent that lasted several minutes, a plummet into blackness. Then they slowed and glided forward again, following an angular, irregular course which took in more smashed-up corridors and another vertical shaft before he was brought before a tall, glowing entrance. The remotes set him down a short distance away, and he finished the journey on foot, following one of the remotes into the glow. It was a circular chamber, empty except for a long cradling plinth at the centre. The curving wall was stippled with triangular tiles, only a few of which shed light on the carpet of dark, thumb-sized splinters that surrounded the plinth. The chamber was still, deadly quiet, yet Akreen's senses were thrumming and oscillating in tune with the resonance which had been so faint earlier.
"These are the remains of the Incarnalith of Kaldro Vryn," said the Inheritor Remote.
"How is the hosting of these fragments accomplished?" Akreen said.
"There is some state alteration involved, but we are not entirely sure how this is achieved," said the remote. "When the human received his portion of the shards, they sank into his flesh. For Azavri, it may be the same, or it may not."
"Very well. I am ready. Should I go over to the centre?"
"If you would be so good. The coalescent awareness of the shards understands our purpose, and is likewise ready to proceed."
There was little else to say. Akreen strode over to the plinth, feeling some of the hard fragments underfoot as he did so. With every step, he could feel tickles of energy, as if he were entering an invisible web.
"It is a faint motile field mesh, and you are the focus," said Gredaz.
Akreen had just reached the plinth when something struck him in his right thigh. There was a curious sensation at the point of impact, a tiny, vibrant sound, and when he looked down, he saw a dark splinter sink into the silvery texture of his skin, leaving no mark behind. Another struck him in the neck, then another in his chest, and another and another. In seconds, it became an incoming torrent of shards, and he stood there, eyes closed, arms outstretched, revelling in the reverberant song that hummed and trembled through his body. The vibrations of it coursed through his skull, his mouth, and his eyes, a thunderous metallic storm of beauty. When the ending came, it was swift, a sudden tailing off, a scattering of stragglers, then an amazing, serene silence. He opened his eyes, stared down at his form, and saw a fading pattern of overlapping circles.
"You now carry the Incarnalith of Kaldro Vryn," said the Inheritor Remote. "The greater part of it, anyway."
"A peculiar situation," said Zivalin. "There is a new presence, but it resides in your body, not your mind, like some kind of half-aware war beast, prowling and hungry." "An over-fanciful evocation, but correct in the essentials," said Gredaz. "Your new passenger is a vestigial sentience like your precursors, but it relies on the instincts of a warrior."
Akreen regarded the Inheritor Remote as it floated over to join him.
"What is the next step?" he asked.
"Given your superlative mastery over the portal web, should I expect a portal gate to the Sun Heart shortly to open before me?"
"The war cage, as we said earlier, is a domain of secrets and secret places. Everyone must, however, live with the consequences of the errors of the past, and we are no different. In the closing stages of the Usurper's War, we fortified several worlds against the enemy alliance, but all fell in the end to vicious and extreme weapons like the mantle munitions, which were then used to smash those worlds and others into uninhabitable wrecks. Victory only served to sharpen their lust for destruction."
which led to the wrecked worlds. Even Zavri juveniles have to learn the history, though it speaks of those events from a somewhat different perspective.
The victors are permitted all manner of atrocities, since they can be attributed to the despised enemy when it comes to writing the histories, said the remote. But we go over these grim happenings so that you may understand what lies ahead of you. What do you know of the ruined road?
Ah, I see,
Gredas murmured in Akreen's thoughts. Akreen curbed his irritation and said, It sounds vaguely familiar. I must have heard the name some time ago, but without any informative context.
It was the path that Maclun took to reach the citadel world of the Shuskar.
Maclun was the leader of the rebel underworkers of Beshefis, whose uprising spread to a dozen worlds, including one of the fleet worlds. His revolt threatened to overwhelm the Shuskar Dominion until they retaliated with biological warfare so lethal that seven worlds had to be quarantined and, after the collapse of the rebellion, patrolled until they could be replaced with new harvest worlds.
Maclun was from one of the Valzo pit cities, said Akreen. Notorious hotbeds of malcontent and criminality.
Maclun was no Valzenian, the inheritor remote said. That was a story put about by Shuskar misleaders. But that's incidental. Our point is that Maclun travelled the ruined road with our help, he and a small band of followers. It is a string of portal gates that lead through the wrecked worlds, ending in that rarity, a hub gate.
Akreen frowned. Normal portal gates provided travel to one, occasionally two, other war cage worlds, but a hub gate could provide a choice of a dozen.
None of the wrecked worlds, or even those of your allies that escaped the greater retaliation, hosted a hub gate.
There have only ever been three, Gredas said. At Nexus City on Togema in the White in Silica, Grand Escalade Headquarters on Ivazal, and on the Citadel World. At least, this is what we are told.
The builders were methodical when it came to large-scale designs, always testing their concepts with pilot projects, and the portal web was no exception. They ordered the construction of a prototype hub gate on an agri-world, and tests were run on the rest of the portal gates as they were gradually encoded into the Shadow Force lattice that holds all the worlds in place. More powerful and sophisticated hub gates were built and hooked into the portal web. Everything worked perfectly, like an intricate dream made real.
So the builders decided against dismantling their prototype, Akreen said. Why?
Official reason given was its research value as a testbed for future improvement. But we think that the builders could not bear to demolish a hand-built thing of beauty. As well as being superlative technologists, they were also great aesthetes.
Just then, Akreen became aware of a cold tingling in his hands. Looking down, he saw groups of Zavri letters slowly appearing and disappearing on his palms, across his knuckles, around his wrists, the same word over and over. Vengeance.
Such consistency, remarked the remote. Kaldro Vryn was never one to curb his impatience.
Ah, splendid! A lover of battles and slaughter, said Zivalin. Your recently ousted precursors should take him to their shriveled little hearts.
Another remote flew into the chamber carrying a small oval object in its bearer field, while the speaker remote continued.
The portal gates that were damaged in the war we repaired slowly over several centuries, now that the victors had turned their attention to other matters. Our resources were rudimentary, almost inadequate, so the repairs lacked the necessary precision. Portal target accuracy is, shall we say, variable, but you should still arrive within 3 evren of the next gate. This detector will keep you on track.
The newcomer remote floated up to him and dropped the oval device into his outstretched hand. At the same time, pinpoints of light began flickering in a narrow portion of the chamber wall. The flickering points formed a tall arch, which soon filled with the pulsing shimmer darkness of a portal gate.
"Some final advice," said the inheritor remote, as a queen moved towards the portal. "Some of the worlds you will have to traverse were so devastated that they have no atmosphere. Others were so poisoned that only the most viciously mutated life forms could hope to survive. The Zavri are exceptional warriors, but even you should exercise caution on the ruined road."
"How did Makhlun survive?" Akreen said.
"Ah, he was the warrior supreme," the remote said, "and we did give him a suit of power armor."
"Oh well, at least we have the splintered remains of the long-departed Kaldro Vryn embedded in our epidermis," said Zivalin. "Who or what would dare stand against us?" Akreen allowed himself a sardonic smile as he walked up to the dark portal and stepped through.